This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Someone in a meeting with me yesterday was asking about Shikantaza. This is a lineage central Zazen practice, Shikantaza, just wholeheartedly sitting. And Dogen Zenji never exactly defines the term in his voluminous writings. And in fact, he doesn't even use the term Shikantaza very much, just a handful of times, mostly in the Shobogenzo Zui Monkey as a name for Zazen. So we could say everything he ever writes is Shikantaza instructions, but he doesn't explicitly say so. So because it's the central practice of the school, and because it's not so clearly defined by the founder and one who began using the term, people interpret it in many different ways and teach it in many different ways. So this person said he was taught Shikantaza as after learning how to count the breath or follow the breath for some time, few months, few years, then his teacher said, okay, now it's time you can learn and practice Shikantaza. So there's it. So that teacher made a distinction, as I think many would, between just following the breath and just sitting. And the difference was, instead of just paying attention to the breath, it was pay attention to everything that's happening without zooming in on one thing, without focusing on one meditation object like the breath. Just whatever arises, just notice it. And whatever ceases, just notice it. I think many people teach and practice Shikantaza in this way. Simple to describe, simple to practice. Not, doesn't mean that it's easy, but simple to explain. Be present with whatever's happening. Whatever sights, whatever sounds, whatever bodily sensations, whatever emotions, whatever thoughts are happening, just notice them and let them go. And then notice the next one and let it go. So this is a wonderful way to practice. Being present is the central intention. Not getting pulled into stories of the past, stories of the future. Be present with the present arising. So that's one way to understand just wholeheartedly sitting Shikantaza. And I said to this person, I like to practice it and teach it in a slightly different way. Not radically different, but the difference being that within the present, there are these experiences arising and ceasing. And rather than having the meditation be focused on the content, which is the present, the arising and ceasing experiences, let the zazen settle into being the space of awareness in which all of this stuff is coming and going. So there's still sights and sounds, bodily sensations, emotions and thoughts arising and ceasing. And it's not that we're exactly ignoring them, and we're definitely not trying to stop them. But rather than the focus being on the content, the present content, the so-called focus is more on being this vast, timeless, boundless space, getting in touch with this space in which this stuff is happening. We might say it's more like identifying with the background more than the foreground. The foreground being content, the background being this blank canvas on which anything can be painted. Clear white sheet of paper, ready for any experience to arise on it. So rather than watching the writing appear in the moment on this sheet of paper, it's like being the sheet of paper. Slight difference. Not so different. But two slightly different versions of just sitting. And this clear white sheet of paper, timeless, boundless, ever-present, ordinary awareness itself, cognizance, knowing, empty knowing, is also called the true self, I would propose. The content, like the presently arising sounds and sensations and feelings, I wouldn't call them the true self. They're arising and ceasing as expressions of the true self. And sometimes Shikantaza may be taught as paying attention to this, the presently arising content, because it's a little bit maybe easier to attend to sound of a bird arises and sound of a bird, that's it. And oh, this knee is just throbbing, waiting for the bell. I just the sensation of knee pain. These experiences, they're tangible, they're still hard to not get caught up in just random thoughts of past and future, but the instructions are easy to understand. The present content, notice the sound, notice the sensation. It's a little bit easier than noticing the background. Why? Because the background of awareness is not another experience. We're so used to paying attention to experiences all day long that in this kind of just sitting, when asked to attend to the background of experience, the space in which all experience is happening, we look for it as another experience. some sort of subtle feeling or object or experience. And yet it's not an experience. It's the only aspect of what's happening that's not an experience. Everything else we can possibly notice is some kind of experience. But the experiencing itself is not another experience. That's why it's not arising and ceasing. And why it can't be grasped or rejected. Why it can't be found or lost. So how can we be this present ordinary mind in which everything is happening, this true self? As far as methods go, that I find a method that is quite helpful for myself. I haven't become jaded by this method. I haven't become bored with this method after quite some years. It might not click for you in the way that it does for me, but I think it can be described as a method to be this methodless space. We need something, otherwise we just revert to habitual mind wandering. So sitting upright, present, letting the breath sink into the lower belly, relaxed breathing, relaxed body, yet upright body, enjoying the breath, enjoying the presence of awareness. Bodily pain on the third day of Sesshin is normal. Discomfort, it's the flavor of Sesshin. No problem, because the present is so delicious. And within this basic settled presence, I ask, is awareness present? Or am I aware? Or is there experiencing? Am I experiencing? Is there knowing? Is there cognizance? These are all different versions of the same question, whichever one suits your taste, you could try out. And we ask such a question in a way that's very curious and open, naive, childlike, simply asking. Not to find some special, complex answer. Not at all. Just, as a way to, direct the mind away from the content and back towards its own nature. Is awareness present? I'm hearing the sound of a bird or feeling the sensation in the legs. I know there's a sound of a bird. I know there's sensation of the legs, but is there awareness of them? Yes. Of course there's awareness of them, otherwise they wouldn't be happening. So yes, there's experience happening all the time. And what makes experience possible? Awareness. There is awareness. As long as there's any experience, there's an experiencing of it. Is there experiencing? So without trying to get a hold of what this experiencing is, just to verify its presence. When we stop and check, we can see yes. And we can know that awareness is present without getting a hold of it. What is it? Where is it? Well, it doesn't seem to be anywhere. What is it? Well, it doesn't seem to be anything. When is it? It doesn't seem to be any time. And yet, it's undeniably the case. Awareness is blazing forth. It's shining radiantly, moment by moment, no matter what state of mind we're in. It's equally shining, illuminating, whatever experience is happening. So, trusting that, and knowing it is so, so that if a Buddha came along and said, you just said awareness is present, but actually I'm going to tell you, it's not. You're not aware right now. That you could like look the Buddha in the eye and say, I don't care what you say. I'm aware right now. The Buddha said, yeah, but you're totally distracted. And you could say to the Buddha, yeah, so what? I'm just aware of being distracted. And the Buddha would say, well, do you think that's some kind of special thing? And you could say to the Buddha, no, it's very ordinary. And it's the same as yours. And the Buddha would say, congratulations. This is the verification, the direct verification of the simple fact of being aware. When we ask, is awareness present sincerely and experientially, as opposed to theoretically, it's not like, well, I'm supposed to know that it's aware, so it must be, because Kokyo said so. No. Like this, but actually, experientially, ask, is awareness present for me right now in a way that no Buddha could convince me otherwise? And at the moment of asking it in such a way, the answer comes, yes, definitely. There is awareness present as long as we're alive, even if we're dreaming, asleep and dreaming. Everything is happening within the space of awareness. The same awareness as when we're awake, exactly the same. The mode is different, the content is different. And when this answer yes comes, upon the practice of asking the question, the verification, yes, arises simultaneously. So this is another example of the non-duality of practice and verification. There's the practice of asking, am I aware? Am I experiencing? And the answer, experiential answer, arises simultaneously with the asking. Yes. Not just a word yes, but like a knowing that it is so. A knowing that we are present. A verification. This is what we mean by it. A direct verification. It's not just an idea that awareness is present. There is the knowing it's present. But then another bird sings and we're like, ooh, that sounded like a blue jay. And now awareness doesn't go anywhere, but our attention goes now to the experience, and we forget the experiencing, the fact of experiencing. And then we can ask again, what was aware of that? What is aware of the sound of the blue jay squawk? Ah, re-verify wholeheartedly, selflessly asking his awareness present the verification of our true self arises simultaneously with such a practice. Practice and verification are not two. And we might say, yes, that's very simple, but this verification is not verification of ultimate reality, is it? That's just a verification that awareness is present. This is a valid question to ask. So then, I might say, is there some way in which this present awareness could be ultimate reality itself? Then we maybe have to discern a little bit of, well, is this actually just dualistic consciousness? Because that's not reality itself. So then, examining our own Shigantaza, subtly, curiously, experientially, looking, does this Shikantaza, does this space of awareness come and go? Does it change with the sensations in the body? Does it change with the sounds in the room? Or is it actually always shining equally with every experience? And at this, we're opening to the timeless dimension of awareness. And then, does this awareness have any location? This present one we're sitting in, we're sitting as, does it have any location? Does it have any edges or borders? Or is it actually locationless? Like space is timeless and unchanging, like space is unlocated and edgeless. If we can verify that this awareness is timeless and boundless, ordinary mind is already this way. We can't make it such, but we can subtly verify by asking, by inquiring into it. I think these two points, then we're really, then we're verifying ultimate reality, I would say. And then we're verifying the fact that it's not ordinary dualistic consciousness, which is just a sense of subjectivity that's knowing an objective world outside itself. And that's coming and going, changing dependent on the experience. It's not, no longer like that. Now it's more like, it's timeless and boundless. And if it's timeless and boundless, we can also explore, inquire and explore. Is it free from, discontent? Particularly nice to check. Is it free when the thoughts of discontent are arising and the feelings in the body and mind of discontent are arising? I, Kokyo, am not quite satisfied with what's happening here. I wish the period would end. I wish that Buddha would stop squawking so loudly. I wish that, I understood what was going on here. These Kokyo can have these thoughts. So right at the time of these unsatisfied thoughts, these thoughts of discontent, we can ask, is the awareness of these thoughts content? Does the awareness of the thoughts change, dependent on whether the thought is content or discontent? So no, it's, there's some aspect of experiencing here that's, always the same, and therefore it's just aware of discontent without itself being discontent. If we can inquire and discern experientially, such points, then we've found a freedom, a reliable freedom that's always free. It doesn't need Tokyo to be okay for himself, for his true self to be okay. So this is the point. This is the reason for such meditations. We're looking for verification of ease and joy, of freedom and openness. This space of awareness is also open to others' suffering, open to our own suffering in a very non-discriminating, open kind of way that we could call compassion. Its very nature is compassion. Compassion here being just not resisting suffering, not afraid of suffering. It's naturally like this. It can't help being like this. Again, Tokyo might be like, I can't stand it anymore. Your suffering, my suffering, any of it. Or it's just too much. But meanwhile, awareness is like, no, it's okay. Actually, it embraces every experience within itself graciously, lovingly, and compassionately. Is our true nature. And so why does the tradition sometimes call it self or Atman? It's such a loaded term. It causes these Buddhists so much trouble. Can't we call it something else? Yes, we can call it our original face. We can call it great compassion. We can call it Buddha nature. Less loaded terms. But is there some reason why the Nirvana Sutra and some of the Zen ancestors use this term self? I would propose that the benefit of using the term self is it reminds us how intimate it is. If we say Buddha nature, I'm looking for my Buddha nature, it can sound kind of abstract and like objectifying it a little bit, removing it a little bit from the fact that it is who we actually are. So something like this term, it is our true self. It is who I really am and who you really are. I think this kind of language reminds us of how intimate it is, how it is not some quality of things or people. It is actually our true identity. This practice is letting our identity as the small self, as the singular, independent, permanent, separate individual entity I think of as myself, as my identity. Letting that identity expand, you might say, or letting that identity shift into a big mind as a new identity, all-inclusive identity, the identity that you and I share, this one mind. Letting our identity shift, because our identity seems to be the root problem. So a little talk about Shikan Taza. It's just what we've been talking about. All things. But it's a method. It's not, let this not be just abstract talk about Dogen before we go back to our Zazen that has nothing to do with this. Let it not be thus. Let this be opening us to Zazen. And as we listen, as we sit here in this talk, we don't need to wait till it's over to practice it. Right there, in the midst of the words, what is the space in which the cognizant space in which these words are arising and ceasing? So before we go back to the essay, I want to bring up another teaching of Dogen, just to bring up some other examples of how he uses this teaching of true self, big self, sometimes. So this is in Shogogenzo Bukyo, I mentioned earlier, the Buddha's teaching. Dogen has an essay called The Buddha's Teaching. And he writes this. Since authentic transmission, which we, as I say, he brings this up in almost every essay, Shoden, authentic transmission. Since authentic transmission is conducted from self to self, the self is within authentic transmission. So we might say, well, how do we know which self he's talking about? He could be talking about the individual self is transmits authentically to another individual self. But he goes on. I'll read this again. Since authentic transmission is conducted from self to self, the self is within authentic transmission. You authentically inherit one mind from one mind. So, again, we'll, what is this? Is this one mind something individual? I think the phrase one means that, from the perspective of one mind, there isn't a second mind. It's a one all-inclusive mind. So, you authentically inherit one mind from one mind. Thus, there is one mind in authentic transmission. The Dharma of one mind, the supreme vehicle, is mud, stone, sand, and pebbles. So this is reminding us that when we're talking about this one mind, the true self, it's not somehow separate from all the experiences happening within it. This clear white sheet of paper is one with the writing on it. This field, this ocean, this space of awareness is one with the knee pain arising and ceasing within it, is one with the thoughts arising within it, is one with the sound of the blue jay arising within it. And in fact, when we examine carefully, which you're welcome to do in Zazen, when the blue jay is singing and you're in touch with your true nature like this, you can examine, is the sound of the blue jay something other than awareness? Or is it actually just awareness itself? Nothing but awareness itself. Or it's taking the form of awareness is manifesting as it's expressing itself as so the Dharma of one mind, the supreme vehicle, is mud, stone, sand, and pebbles. Any possible experience of any possible anything in this world is the one mind. So Shakyamuni Buddha said, I expound these nine divisions of Dharma to suit all beings. So this is, as our present essay talks about these 12 divisions and 9 divisions of sutras. And this is what is being spoken of here in this essay on the Buddha's teaching. I expound these 9 divisions of Dharma teachings to suit different types of people. This is the basis for entering the great vehicle. Thus, I expound these sutras, the Buddha says. And now Dogen comments, know that Buddha says, I expound these sutras. Dogen says, know that I is the Tathagata, the Buddha. His face, eyes, body, and mind are expressed. This I is already the nine divisions of Dharma. This, you know, capital I, right? This me, this self. You could translate it as self. The nine divisions of Dharma are the I, capital I, are the self. Each phrase, each verse expounded now is the nine divisions of Dharma. Because of I, the nine divisions of Dharma are expounded to suit different types of beings. This being so, all birth of sentient beings is born inside this. It's inside this true self. That is why I expound these sutras. All death dies inside this. That is why I expound these sutras. All beings follow. I expound these nine divisions of Dharma. To follow is to follow others, the self, all beings, birth, I, and this. As all beings are invariably I, or the self, they are every line of the nine divisions of Dharma. So this I, when Shakyamuni Buddha uses the word I, this is the true self he's speaking of, and then Dogen's riffing on this and saying that the nine divisions of the Buddha's teachings are nothing but this I, and all of us are this I, and birth happens within this I, death happens inside this I. As all beings are invariably I, invariably the self, they are all these divisions of sutras. All beings are the sutras. This is crazy non-dual ocean talk of Dogen. And I just bring it up here because he's really getting into this I, capital I, self as the source and reality of all things, the true self. And it's related to our topic too, because there's this verification by teachers and verification by sutras in our present essay. And sutras are oneself, Dogen has already said, in Jisho Zamai. When we're verified by sutras, this verification is verification truly by oneself, of oneself, for oneself, the self that includes everyone. So, that could be a topic for another Genzoe session, the Buddha's teaching. But here we return to Sobo Genzo Jisho Zamai. Near the last paragraph, at the bottom of page 2, Dogen Zenji says, "Rejoice, hope for, and have the aspiration for bringing Buddha Dharma, the ancestor's way, closer to the body and mind of the self." Another translation says, closer to your body and mind. Would be a more colloquial way to say it, but since there's so much about self in this essay, this translation puts it in there literally. Which is nice, I think. this is again now, we're in this section where Dobbins is like, I think, just getting into how wonderful and rare and precious it is to be able to study Dharma and to speak about Dharma in this lifetime and throughout all lifetimes. And we can rejoice, hope for, and aspire to bring the Buddha's Dharma, the ancestors' way, closer to the body and mind of the true self, you could say. We want to bring all our Dharma study more and more in line with our true nature. We want to remember that the study is happening within our true nature. There's nothing outside of this true self. Extend this practice. This is a good one for Sashin. Extend this practice from 1 hour to 1 day, then to 1 year and to one lifetime. So start off now, study Dharma for 1 hour today, and then extend this to all day. Doesn't mean study some text. If in order to be all day and all year and all lifetime, this kind of study of Dharma, you could say, is just being open and curious about whatever's happening all day long, and open to the possibility that everything that's happening and everyone we meet is ourself. Make Buddhas and ancestors Dharma your essential spirit, the essential spirit, and play with it. This is one of these Zen phrases, playing with the vital spirit. Sometimes means true practice. This is to live your life meaningfully. So do not think that you should not speak of Dharma to others until you master it or clarify it. I mentioned this yesterday. Dobbins, it's kind of an unusual section here where Dobbins getting very, kind of personal and saying, don't think that you can actually completely master and clarify all the Dharma in this lifetime. Sometimes he kind of implies, when he's really like inspired, he'll say, you must clarify everything to the very tiniest dust mote, this kind of talk. But here he's like kind of humbly saying, don't think you should not speak of Dharma to others until you clarify it or master it. If you wait until you master it, it will not be possible for countless eons. That's the humble part. Even if you have mastered human Buddhas, you need to master celestial Buddhas, you know, Deva Buddhas. Going back to this, there's the vehicle of gods and humans. So we're kind of playing with this idea. We're used to human Buddhas, but what about those awakened ones and these invisible celestial realms? We have to clarify those, master those. Even if you've mastered the heart of mountains, you need to master the heart of waters. Even if you've mastered the Dharma, the Dharmas arising from causes and conditions, you need to master the Dharmas that don't arise from causes and conditions. So the Dharmas beyond arising from causes and conditions would be one way to translate this. And this could mean, in Abhidharma language, in Buddhist psychology, all experiences, there's 75 kind of states of mind. Maybe in our language this week, we could say 75 dharmas, they're called phenomena. But maybe we could say 75 experiences, 75 types of experience that arise within boundless experiencing. And of these 75 phenomena or experiences, 72 of them are conditioned or samskritta dharmas. They're compounded or conditioned, like color and sound are dharmas. They arise due to conditions. Greed and hate are dharmas. They arise from conditions. Almost all of these dharmas or experiences arise from conditions. But there's three dharmas that, of the 75 that are uncompounded or unconditioned. Asamskrita in the Abhidharma system. And they are, kind of wonderfully, one of them is called space. Physical space. So not aware space in the Abhidharma, but outer space. Here, this week, we're mostly talking about inner space. So-called inner. It's not really inner or outer, but not an outer space. An unlocated space. But in Abhidharma, they're talking about physical outer space is actually one of the few things, one of the few experiences or phenomena in this universe that's not conditioned or compounded. It's like it's not made of parts. It has no location. It doesn't come and go. These are all qualities of conditioned, compounded things. So that's why space is such a wonderful analogy for ordinary mind. Ordinary mind, the true self, is unconditioned in the teachings of Buddha nature. It is uncompounded, unconditioned. It doesn't arise and cease. It's not an impermanent experience. It's eternal. It's not a permanent entity. It's just that it doesn't change because it's not a thing to change. It's unborn and undying. So space is one of the unconditioned dharmas. And then there's the other two are two types of cessation. Nirodha is very similar to nirvana. It's a synonym of nirvana. Nirvana in the Buddha's early teachings is said to be unconditioned, uncompounded. You might say a person might realize nirvana at a certain time and place, but what they realize is not something that just arises and ceases. They're realizing a reality that's unconditioned. Again, very similar to this true self, which in like the Nirvana Sutra is called complete nirvana. This Buddha nature, another name for it is complete nirvana. Or nirvana means like total freedom. And nirodha means cessation. So this total freedom is a cessation of any graspable anything. And it's particularly a cessation of greed, hate, and delusion. It's a cessation of suffering. So so the Abhidharma, these unconditioned dharmas are space and a kind of natural cessation that just is the cessation when something ends, and a kind of maybe realized cessation through practice. So when Dogen is saying here, depending on how it's translated, it's a, even if you've mastered the dharmas or the phenomena that arise from conditions, you still need to master the dharmas that do not arise or are not born from conditions. Like fixation, fixation. Even if you've mastered the realm of Buddhas and ancestors, you need to master going beyond Buddhas and ancestors. The Dogen has a whole essay called Going Beyond Buddha. So, okay, I got Buddhas and ancestors, but now any possible idea I have about Buddhas and ancestors, now I have to go beyond all those ideas, even if they're good ones. So this is Dogen just saying how far-reaching mastery or clarification can be, that we can't complete this in one lifetime. Trying to speak to others after mastering all of these or after clarifying all of these in one lifetime is not an endeavor of a person, and it is not the study. I think it's a very interesting sentence of Dogen. He's very kind of firm about, like, don't try to master all of this in one lifetime. It's an unusually humble and realistic statement of Dogen. Trying to speak to others about Dharma after mastering and clarifying all of these points in one lifetime is not the endeavor. Here's Khufu, or Chinese Kung Fu, which means like wholehearted effort of a person. And it's not the Sangaku, the study, the meeting study of the way. Studying the way of Buddhas and ancestors is to raise the aspiration as high as heaven for speaking to others, or another translation says, for helping others from the moment of studying one Dharma and one procedure, or one practice. So, again, continuing this humble theme of, don't try to master everything and then from your mastery speak of Dharma. That's not the way studying the way of Buddhas and ancestors. Studying the way of Buddhas and ancestors is to just aspire, to wholeheartedly aspire, to raise the aspiration as high as heaven. Like heaven, you know, the highest aspirations to help others, to speak about Dharma clearly from the moment of studying one Dharma right here and now, and one procedure or practice that we're practicing here and now. And I think this feels to me like, let's aspire to do this forever and ever and deepen this forever and ever. So if Zen is the sudden school, this is kind of, sounds like it's promoting a kind of gradual practice, which is kind of realistic. And aspire wholeheartedly right now to continue lifetime after lifetime. Thus you drop off Datsuraku, self and others. This time the translators put in parentheses, drop away, become free from, which I think is nice. Commentary on Datsuraku. Datsuraku means drop off, or sometimes they just slough off. It's like, it's used for like when, like getting undressed, like dropping off your clothing. What means, so drop off body and mind means, to become free from body and mind. Many commentary from Kaz Tanahashi. In this case, you drop off self and others. You become free from the limited view of self and others as separate. that kind of self in others. Further, studying yourself thoroughly is studying others thoroughly. Playing again with these different connotations of self. If you study your true self thoroughly, that is, of course, studying others thoroughly because others are included within our true self. Studying others thoroughly is actually studying yourself thoroughly because others are yourself. This practice of Buddhas and ancestors cannot be experienced with the body without receiving it from a teacher. So, literally it says this, experience with the body, but another translation says, cannot be realized personally or experienced personally. So that's one of the, more colloquial meanings of with the body means personally experienced with this body, which is, I think, getting at the meaning of it. So we could say this practice of Buddhas and ancestors cannot be personally realized without receiving it from a teacher, even if you have knowledge by birth. This is term shochi, inborn knowledge or wisdom or knowing. Innate knowing. Something like this. So, even if you have this innate knowing, which I would say one way to look at innate knowing would be, guess what? This present awareness, this Buddha nature we were born with, it's just like we're born with the programming of the separate illusory self. Imagine even little kids have the file that the program is installed. It just hasn't been opened yet. At some age, the program is activated and they say, they grab the toy back from you and say, it's mine! The activation of the view of the separate self. Pretty young. And, but also, in addition to the illusory separate self that comes at birth, is inherited according to the Buddha's teaching, or born due to this false view, and, it gets activated pretty early, and we operate through our lives with this misunderstanding of a separate self. In the same way, our Buddha nature, our true self, is innate. Is how could it be otherwise? Our birth is born out of this true self. Is our death is dying into this true self. There's no escape from the true self, and there's almost no escape from the false self. But the Buddha says there is an escape, which is just seeing clearly. And so, even if you have kind of innate knowing or knowledge by birth, like you have some innate understanding, which everybody does in a way, but you could say some people really seem to be able to access their true nature maybe from a very young age. But Dogen's saying it doesn't matter. The practice of Buddhas and ancestors cannot be personally realized without receiving it from a teacher, even if you have this innate knowing. Knowledge by birth or innate knowing does not know knowledge beyond birth, and beyond knowledge, beyond birth. Typical, Dogen. So, kind of saying, it's not quite complete. And there's this dynamic thing going on with the Chinese characters here. It's knowing by birth, or birth knowing, and then when Dogen puts negatives on it, you don't have the knowing, the well, here, beyond, you don't have knowledge, no knowledge beyond birth, and beyond knowledge beyond birth. So there's some double negatives in here. But one of the negatives is not birth knowing. So again, Shochi is born knowing, or birth knowing. And to put a negative in front of it, Fu, not birth knowing, could also be read as knowing the unborn. The Fu Sho is the unborn, like Zen ancestor Bonke. That was his great realization of Buddha nature, was this phrase, the unborn, that same phrase, Fu Sho, not the not born. Bonke came after Dogen, so Dogen isn't referring to that, but it's a Zen phrase, the unborn. And it's a nice meditation to contemplate. It's another name for our true nature, is the unborn. It wasn't born when the body was born, and it doesn't die when the body dies. It's ever present and unchanging. So there's a little like word play that gets hard to translate into English here. Knowledge by birth does not know knowledge beyond birth. Knowledge by birth does not know the unborn, is another meaning. Even those who have knowledge by birth would not know the great way of Buddhas and ancestors unless they study it. So, this is, I think, one of the major themes of this essay, woven in here, and, is that even if you have some spontaneous awakening to your true nature, which people do, Dogen saying you still need this, a verification by a teacher also. And the teacher is yourself. So, that's one of, kind of summary of one of the themes here. It's self-verification. It's always about self-verification in the large sense of self. But the self-verification must include, so-called teacher verification. And so this is one of the places he's bringing up that point. In other words, even though Buddha nature is innate, it must be pointed out by a teacher or a sutra in order to recognize it. And some might say, well, some even recognize it without a teacher or a sutra, but have a spontaneous verification. It's true, I think. And but then even so, we could say that to clarify all the nuances of this understanding, then we have these particular traditions that clarify it. So often people have these spontaneous awakenings before they get into practice. They're like, they lose it again. They lose touch with it, the verification. And say, everything was perfectly fine. How can I find it again? Because it's not so clear that it can be found again. It's like, I have a sense of it, but it's gone now. And then the practice lineages are saying, here's methodical ways to clarify what happened there. And so we can find our way back. So it's not just random. In modern Zen, there's a saying going around, enlightenment is an accident, and there are certain practices that make us accident prone. it's kind of nice. But I would say the tradition within Buddha Dharma and even Zen doesn't really say that it's an accident. It does say there are certain practices that help us to verify it, but there are also teachings like if one practices completely these practices and clarifies what needs to be practiced, then awakening is inevitable. It's impossible not to realize it. So in this case, Dogen is saying, emphasizing we need a teacher or a sutra or both. We need some so-called other to verify ourself. And partly what's being verified is that the so-called other is not really other. We need an other to verify that there is no other. That would be another kind of simple summary of this whole essay. To experience yourself with the body, or to experience the self personally and experience others personally, is the great road of Buddhas and ancestors. Just turn the study of your beginner's mind and study simultaneously with others' beginner's mind. This term, Shoshin, beginner's mind, that made famous by Suzuki Roshi, is throughout the Shobogenzo. It's not a extremely prominent Buddhist term, so I think that probably Suzuki Roshi is getting it from Dogen. But it means, you know, like beginner's mind. Has this quality of kind of like curious and naive and open. Like Suzuki Roshi famously says, in the beginner's mind there are many possibilities. In the expert's mind, there are few. That's a great commentary on beginner's mind. So this is a quality of practice. And this kind of investigation, inquiry into our true self by asking, is awareness present? I think one of the key aspects of asking this kind of question is to ask it with beginner's mind, especially after one's asked it like hundreds of thousands of times, to not have it be a rote thing. Is awareness present? Yes. It's like, no, ask it like we're asking it the very first time. Actually, I wonder, is awareness present? Like a beginner's mind would ask. So here Dogen is saying, just turn the study, let this study flow freely and turn the study of your beginner's mind and study simultaneously with others' beginner's minds, just like we're doing here. When self and others study together with beginner's mind, you arrive together at the ultimate realm. In this way, your own endeavor encourages the endeavor of others. However, hearing the words self-verification and self-awakening, this came up yesterday, right? Jisho and Jigo. Self-awakening. Go is Satori. Ji Satori. And Jisho. Hearing these words that are words of Da Wei, which we're going to get to, the ancestor Da Wei. Hearing those words that he uses, Jisho and Jigo, foolish people think that this is to receive transmission without a teacher, and that one only needs to study by oneself. This is a great mistake. Those who make a crooked interpretation of self-verification without receiving instructions from a teacher are the same as those outside the way in India who believed in spontaneous enlightenment. Spontaneous enlightenment is one of these terms in Zen. It's literally like it, 10 men, literally like heaven's working. So kind of like, wow, it's just, this is the way it is because this is the workings of heaven to make it as it is. And I got it. Something like this is the feeling of this spontaneous enlightenment that doesn't rely on practice or verification by self or others. And there were those outside the Buddha way in India who had such a view. How can those who do not understand this be considered practitioners of the Buddha way? Furthermore, those who hear the words self-verification, self-realization, and assume that this is the accumulation of the five skandhas are simply abiding in the practice of self-control in the lesser vehicles. Hinayana, the small vehicles. There are many of those who do not understand the great and lesser vehicles who call themselves descendants of Buddhas and ancestors. There are many who don't understand the Hinayana and Mahayana and the relationship, but they say they're Buddhas and ancestors. Who with clear eyes would be fooled by them? So this is a great point here, I think, that people hear this self-verification. So this is a little commentary on this word self again. They assume that this kind of self is the self of the accumulated five aggregates, the self of the five skandhas. Even in a subtle way. So we talked about this earlier, right? The first kind of self, conventional self, is just the collection of the five skandhas, five aggregates, body, or form, feelings, perceptions or conceptions, karmic formations, or habitual conditioned patterns, and dualistic consciousness, the consciousness that that mediates between a subject and an object. Consciousness that always arises dependent on an object and arises and ceases as the object changes. That's the fifth skandha of Vijnana consciousness. So this collection of five aggregates we think of as ourself. And even when we hear such teachings, we might feel like, but that is a kind of conventional self. That's who we are. And if we don't grasp, it as the second type of self, which is a kind of limited, fixed, grasped idea of the five skandhas, or the owner of the five skandhas, or the controller of the five skandhas, or the assessor of the five skandhas. These are the false views of self. Something to do with the five skandhas. It's either within the five skandhas or just outside the five skandhas that's somehow managing them. We feel as if there's such a singular, independent, permanent self. Whereas the five skandhas are not singular. There's five of them. They're not permanent. They're constantly changing. They're not independent. They all depend on each other, and they depend on other elements in the world. So one might feel like, well, if I don't have this reified separate self, how about who I really am is just the five skandhas, freely flowing, impermanent five skandhas? That doesn't seem so problematic. And in a way, I would agree. It's not so problematic. It's just, it's a conventional person, that we say I, we use the word I for this set of constantly changing five skandhas, body and mind, we call a person, but there's no fixed entity there. And I think some people do interpret that that's our true self in early pre-Mahayana teachings. It almost starts sounding that way. It's okay to say that's who we really are as long as we don't feel like there's an owner of it, or we don't reify, solidify the five aggregates. But from this week's discussion, we say that's not the true self. That's still just a conditioned set of skandhas. That's just, we call it a person. It's not too problematic to not grasp it, but it's still limited. That kind of self is still going to die. For example, it was born and it dies, this collection of five aggregates. And so it's, we have a little fear, even if we're not reifying it. If I am just five aggregates, impermanent five aggregates, still there's a little bit like, well, what's going to happen to me when the elements start falling apart? If we're identified with the five aggregates in any possible way, it's somewhat limited compared to the true self is unlimited. So if our true identity is Buddha nature, the unborn awareness, then our true identity doesn't actually die. So this is a subtle point here. And I think what Dogi may be saying is that people hear this self-verification and they think that this is a verification by the five aggregates, maybe particularly by the fifth aggregate, which is called dualistic consciousness. We might even feel right now that, like, yes, my thinking mind, my consciousness really gets this view, and I got it. I am this collection of five aggregates is unborn Buddha nature. Cool. I got it. We like have this kind of feeling. And, but who's thinking that? Is it not actually just the fifth aggregate, the conceptual and dualistic consciousness that got it? So it's, you could say this getting it is just being verified by the fifth skanda or the collection of five skandhas, rather than the verification is by the true self. Self-verification is Buddha nature is verifying itself as itself. We want to have a human verification, but it's somewhat limited. A human verification is a five skandhas verification. It's not true self verification. Only true nature can truly verify itself in a completely authentic and unobstructed way. So we could hear Dogen as meaning this. We hear self-realization, but we assume that this self is the accumulated five aggregates that are gathered and then disperse. And this kind of self that is the five aggregates would somehow need to be controlled into a realization. Okay, like, I'm gonna get it now, and like, got it. And there's some self-control involved here, which is Dogen's making a sort of cut against the small vehicles, which is a narrow-minded approach to practice. Not talking about Theravada Buddhism, for example, but just a small-minded approach to practice. The Hinayana. I think we can use the term Hinayana, which is a term invented by Mahayana, but not as an equivalent for Theravada Buddhism, but as a as an attitude that the Mahayana is critiquing, a kind of small-minded, narrow-minded attitude, or limited understanding, according to the Mahayana. Hine means like lesser, and it gets translated into Chinese as small. And the Mahayana is the great vehicle. And so some hear this term self-verification and assume it's the five aggregates self is what's verifying reality and being verified by dualistic consciousness as the true self, merely just the collection of five aggregates. But this is abiding in the practice of self-control of the lesser vehicles. It's some sort of contrived conceptual idea, rather than the direct verification of being awareness itself that verifies itself by being itself. And in a very uncontrived, uncontrolled way, yes, we intentionally take a nice posture, we intentionally let go of our thoughts, we intentionally settle into the present, we intentionally let the breath settle into the lower belly. Control is a kind of strong word, but we can set forth all these intentions, preliminary intentions, and then by setting all that up, then naturally and effortlessly and in an uncontrived way, the verification of the true self by the true self comes into view, is present. And the person can appreciate that happening. The person can enjoy that verification, but the person's not doing the verification. So the briefly introduce this character Da Wei. He's kind of the rest of the essay now for another like two and a half pages is going to be all stories about Da Wei and Dogen kind of teasing Da Wei. So this afternoon we'll introduce what's he going on here. Why is he like poking so hard at Da Wei? Da Wei, in one of his letters, he had this student who was practicing silent illumination, like Shikantaza, and Da Wei didn't really approve of that kind of practice, so he kind of criticized his student, and the student got kind of angry at his teacher for criticizing him, and then he started doubting his own practice. But then he had this kind of spontaneous awakening, and at that point Da Wei praised the student and said, this matter cannot be transmitted and cannot be learned. So this is, I think, what Dogen is criticizing in one of Dawei's letters. Like, this was not transmitted to you and you didn't learn it. It must be self-verification and self-enlightenment. These two terms again, Jisho and Jigo. And, self-verification, self-awakening, self-affirmation, self-stopping. And then you will, for the first time, get to the bottom of things. That's a quote from Da Wei. And I think this is one of the commentators who says that's the quote that Dogen knows of and is criticizing from here on out when And he says, in this paragraph we just read, those who hear the words self-verification and self-awakening, they assume this is just something about the five skandhas, and they don't understand that they actually need verification from a teacher. So Da Wei said, even though he was the teacher of this student, he praised the student for getting it on his own. This matter cannot be transmitted and cannot be learned from a teacher. It must be self-verification, self-awakening, self-affirmation, self-stopping, and then you will, for the first time, get to the bottom of it. That's a first quote from Da Wei, related to this essay. Any clarifications, particularly on the practice method, verification of true self, or anything else that came up today?
Kokyo. AKA Jeff, depending on how I was introduced.
Hi. What's your other name besides Jeff?
Shouju.
Shouju, Jeff, hi.
I see you at Noabo, and I actually did Dokusan with you at a Valley Streams retreat maybe 5 years ago. In a room, there was like this beautiful black lacquer altar, and I think I asked you something about koan practice.
Yes, I vaguely remember. Yes. Yeah, so good to see you again.
I can see you. I'm glad to see you're feeling well.
Yes.
I don't know how clear this will be. My blood sugar crashed. I just got really tired all of a sudden. But I did, earlier, something you said reminded me of, I think it was, a monk asked, I think it was Zhuanzang. He said, what is it? Why can't I understand it? Or why can't I see it? And Zhuanzang said, because it's too close. And, reading Dogen has always, I don't know, I've always felt like, it's interesting because the first thing text I ever read when I started studying Buddhism and got involved with Zen was the Genjo Koan. It was introduced to me and someone said, this is really important, read this. So I read it and then wrote it out. And I never really studied Dogen again after that. I would read it and it always seemed like, you know, the pictures of the reverse, the foreground and background would kind of, you had to really look at it just the right way for it to. Yeah. So that has always kind of been like that. But this, thank you. This, teaching has been really clear. It's been wonderful. I did not expect to hear the Tathagata Garba Yogacara teachings brought up with Dogen. And, it's really been wonderful in a sense. I've studied the Vasubandhu 30 verses. I studied Yogacharan quite a bit, I think, probably because of reading the third turning of the wheel. And, by the way, I loved, it was a very apropos when you said that you seem like some people could see you're a rebel in the way you're teaching this, which would make sense. Your teacher's name's Reb. It's short for rebel. So I think that makes sense. But, it's really seemed to open up these teachings. It's been wonderful that, this is the second fascicle that I've actually read of Dogen's, and, it seems to, in a sense, you know, we're studying the Avatamsaka Sutra now, Reb's teaching that in No Abode. Oh, and also thank you for No Abode as well. I know you have some history in establishing that, so I thank you very much for that. And, so I don't know, maybe
that you're getting to study this, this essay of Dogen. As I say, it's not a well-known one at all. I wouldn't recommended in the top 10 even or anything, but it just shows that if you go through very slowly, line by line, it brings out the teaching of Dogen, and each one of them is an amazing, precious jewel when we kind of really spend time, study thoroughly, as Dogen says, his words. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it's studying that sutra, it seems to also have like stitched all these other teachings together. Even koans are now seem to be coming more, I don't know if understand them more, but having some more insight with them. And I know the Avatamsaka Sutra, it's like there's a synchronicity or maybe more like a holographic thing that happens with working with other teachings. And I'm finding that now reading this sutra, it's just really wonderful. Just a few things. Well, my main question was, you made a subtle hint earlier that the Buddha said about seeing clearly. So we're saying non-duality is not one. It's seeing clearly. Is that correct? Or would it be incorrect?
I don't remember what I said, but that sounds like a valid statement, that non-duality is seeing clearly. And I think when we say non-duality, one point to bring up here is that, non-duality can be, mean many different things. Many different things are non-dual with each other. And, like there's the non-duality of, in the ultimate space, the non-duality of good and bad, for example, or, like the six ancestors said, without thinking good and bad, what's your original face? That's a kind of non-duality, but I don't think it's such an important one. I think usually in these, Dharma traditions, the key non-duality, I would say, is the subject-object non-duality. And that's in Yogacara, that's the one that's mentioned in the Buddhist tradition, where they call it, instead of subject and object, I think quite wonderfully, that tradition usually uses the term, grasper and grasped non-duality. In other words, the subject is the grasper, and the objects like colors and sounds and thoughts and sensations are the grasped. And because experientially that's how it is. And then the tradition saying that grasper and grasped are actually non-dual. And when we realize that they're not two different things, it's just one mind, that is the release from the grasping and the grasped. In other words, in order to grasp an object, there needs to be a subject separate from it to grasp. There needs to be this duality, this separation, in order for there to be grasping. And then grasping is also like Buddha's definition of discontent is grasping, holding. It's suffering itself is grasping. So the Yogacara tradition will say, let's look at the root of what is suffering, what is grasping. It's this illusory division into a subject and an object. And so these teachings this week are definitely getting at that too. We're saying that this true self, Buddha nature, is a non-dual awareness, means that the awareness itself is not divided into a grasped and a grasper. It's not divided into a subject and an object, which is another thing to meditate on as we're clarifying the nuances of it, is we can start to feel like, is awareness present? Yes, that's me. That's actually the observer. I got it. Awareness is the observer, the grasper.
You're saying non-dual awareness.
Yeah, right. So it's not the observer. The awareness we're talking about is not the observer, which would be just a subtle version of separate self, a subtle version of the grasper. But what we're saying is that it's not the observer, but it is the observing. It's not the experiencer, but it's the experiencing. And experiencing seems to be divided into an experiencer and an experience, but actually it's not. It's like a dream is one mind in it when we're dreaming, but it seems to be divided into a subject and an object. So just to make that point for everybody, that when we mention non-duality, I think this is the key type of non-duality. Non-duality is used so much in contemporary spirituality. And I think the subject-object non-duality is the key liberating, point. And then we also have, say, like the non-duality of Buddhas and sentient beings. The non-duality of awakened Buddhas and deluded sentient beings. But that's, I would say, based on realizing the subject-object non-duality.
Yeah, that's what this fascicle seemed like, a call to action where we're merging subject and object and making real. The realization is, I was working with, to make it real.
Yes.
Activity in our, to make reality real.
Yes, realization is a nice word in English because it has a double meaning. It means to make real, and it also means to understand, and both are true. And then verification is a little different feeling, but it's almost a little, I like the term verification because it's a little more specific. It's like there is reality is verified. And it verifies itself. So that's an interesting, tricky point here too. Because we think I as the person want to verify reality, or I as the person want to realize reality, but it's more like the true non-dual realization or verification must be reality realizing itself or verifying itself. And the person can sort of be on the side, enjoying the process, but it's not as important as the reality verifying itself.
I think they're standing, they're in the bleacher seats.
In the bleachers, yes, yes.
You lost me a little bit when you were talking about the skandhas because, you know, the Buddha, and I think maybe it's the Dhammapada or somewhere says, the Buddha says we are the five. And so I assume he's saying when he says we, he means himself.
Yeah, if you find that quote, I'd be very curious to see it because
I thought that was a well-known quote. It's somewhere.
No, I never heard, and it might be. I would be surprised if it was like we are. I am the five, because usually it's taught more like I am not the five skandhas, like often the teachings of anatta or anatman, the Buddha is saying, he lists each of the five. He says, form is not myself. Feeling is not myself. Conception is not myself. Formation is not myself. Consciousness, dualistic consciousness is not myself. That's the usual formulation in the early teachings. Means like, that's not who I really am. This body is not who I really am. This dualistic consciousness is not who I really am. But he never did say, there is no self. He just said, each of these five are not the self. And the package of all five together is not myself.
Well, I know, Avalokiteshvara, finding that there is no self in those aggregates is liberation, is when you have that view, then that's liberating. So,
yeah, or strictly speaking, the Heart Sutra says, saw that these five aggregates are empty. The word self doesn't actually appear there. One could say that it means that's true, that the five aggregates are not self. And in addition to the fact that they're not who I am, each of the five can't really be found either. So that would be the Heart Sutra's additional point, like form or this body is empty. Or as the sutra later says, there is no body. There is no form. There's no formation. no consciousness. And then beautifully, the sutra makes the non-dual statement that form itself is emptiness. Emptiness is form. And if we, in light of this week's teachings, we could say emptiness could be another name for our true self, for the space of awareness. We could call it emptiness, empty space. And that is form in the sense that when we're looking at a color, that color is the empty space of awareness.
Yeah, I like how Reb says, he'll say, that view is liberating, and don't abide in that, and don't, because that's everything, and don't abide in everything, because that's just suffering. Mm-hmm. And that's very beneficial.
Yeah, not, so right view, it liberates us, but if we abide in it, meaning like, kind of hold on to it, then we're a little bit stuck. Which is maybe part of the point of this last paragraph about the five skandhas, is if we think the five skandhas are verifying reality somehow, then there might be some abiding in that. But if reality is just verifying itself, there's nothing there to abide.
Well, I had many more questions. Maybe I'll wait, Sir Doka-san. Thank you for bringing this Yogacara into it implicitly. It seemed like the only other teacher, like Hakuin, I know his one book that I've read on Hakuin's Four Modes of Knowing or something, talking about Yogacara. But you really don't see it implicit anywhere else.
Yeah, it's not that implicit, but it's woven in, big influence on the whole Zen tradition. And Dogen, for example, has a Shobo Genzo essay called The Three Realms Are Mind Only. So that's kind of explicit. And occasionally he'll quote some other things like that from Yogacara, but you're right that it's a new language that's,
I meant explicit.
What's that?
I did mean explicit, you're right, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Zen uses this strange new Chinese kind of language outside the scriptures. Thank you very much. Thanks for being here, Physician.
Thank you.
So it's almost lunchtime.
Yes.
So let's adjourn till the afternoon. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of God's way.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jikoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jikoji, please visit us on the web at jikoji.org.